Today is Friday, March 3rd, 2023. This is part three of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charlie Spulz. My name is Tom Martin. Charlie, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. And how are you doing today?
Just fine so far.
Good. Okay.
I've been out and nice walk this, it started about noon or 11 o'clock, got back about 1, and nice walk, and beautiful day out here, actually.
Lovely. And this is in Tucson, Arizona, so we're envious of your nice weather today. Last time we left off in part two, you were working in the 1974-75 kind of time frame for Hanson's Auto Parts, and then finished off your studies there at the University of Arizona and got a job for Bell Labs. And that meant you had to leave Tucson, is that right?
That's correct. And I had an obligation because I had finished and got my commission after I finished my bachelor's degree. And then I still had, and I got my commission at that time as a second lieutenant in the Air Force. And so I got a deferment to allow me to get my master's in computer science. And when I finished that, I still owed the Air Force some time. And they came out with a program in that same time in 1974, winding down their officer corps because the Vietnam War was winding down and they didn't need as many officers. And so I was surprised because they offered me a six-month active duty stint, and then I would go into the reserves.
Okay.
The end reserves, and I could go ahead and pursue a career outside the Air Force. So I started taking interviews, and I interviewed at several places, but the one that was really interesting to me and somewhat prestigious was to go to Bell Labs and work in New Jersey in one of their research and development groups there. So I went and went to March Air Force Base in California for 6 months and finished that in July of 1976, moved my then wife and my son, who had been born about 2 years when I came back from Korea and was finishing up my bachelor's degree at the University of Arizona. And we went from here to up near the Sacramento area to March Air Force Base, and then from there to Piscataway, New Jersey.
Wow.
And that's where we bought a house, and that's where I started working at Bell Labs.
What were you doing for Bell?
I was a software engineer at that point. We were developing software for managing parts of their switching centers, the equipment in the switching centers. And Bell is kind of have to, a lot of people don't understand the relationship at that time because it's so different now from what it was. But in 1966, AT&T essentially was the major phone service supplier in the United States.
Right.
They weren't totally everywhere, but they had all the big cities and all the major parts of the country with a few exceptions. And they had their own research and development facility. That was Bell Labs.
Okay.
They had their own manufacturing. That was Western Electric. And then they had all the operating companies. So they owned it from top to bottom.
Wow.
So if you wanted to do anything in the wireline network at that time, it had to go through their standards, their evaluations. And they even had a group that set standards for the network in the United States. And that was called Bellcore. And that was a joint operation between the operating companies and Bell Labs and Western Electric. The three of them supplied people who had the knowledge to Bellcore to set the standards. And basically, they told the government, this is what we were going to do. And the government said, okay. But that resulted in, right at that about that same time, the divestiture activity that broke up the Bell Company. And so it was quite a change for people in the United States in general, but also for the company in a large part because AT&T, the long-distance part, was split out separately, the Bell operating companies were split out. So you had several operating companies in the United States were split out. And Western Electric was set off as a separate company. And Bell Labs was actually broken up into different parts. And there was the pure research part, which was still funded by the operating companies. There was the applied part, which really worked on kind of contract basis. The Bell operating companies would decide they wanted something done or a combination of new technology with ideas they'd have, and they would say, okay, we want this kind of part of Bell Labs to develop it, and they would put money in it, and it would get done. And then there was Bellcor, which was the standards group, which when they started to split things up, then you had all the other people who wanted to make money off the split up, all the people had new ideas for how the network should run, got involved, and Bellcor ended up being spun off as a standalone company as well. But it was provided or became much more integrated with, or not integrated with, the people inside of it were no longer just Bell people. There were people from who wanted to, change the network, build the network bigger, make more opportunities, make it possible for anybody to hook a phone to the network and things like that. Originally, when Bell ran it, you could connect any phone to their network without them approving it, and they wouldn't approve it because they didn't build it. So,
interesting.
All that changed with the breakup of the Bell companies right in that same time frame.
So when I go down today to buy a base station with a bunch of little remotes for my house, and that's built by it's going to say Motorola, somebody not AT&T. This is the outcome of that divestiture.
Yes, correct. Okay. That's one of the outcomes.
All right.
The other one is all the long distance services that popped up. Then for a long time, the only company any call you made long distance, it was going to be on an AT&T network.
Right.
And there was all kinds of ways that the funding was split up and all those kind of things. Even when it was part of the Bellcor or one company, but when it got broke up, then it even got more complex. And then you had other companies entering into the long distance service, so you could subscribe to a different long distance subscriber. But then the cell phone industry, and this is a little later in my career, just blew all that apart. So that's a whole different change in the thing. This was still happening while there was no such thing as a cell phone.
Right.
And the companies, the operating companies, the wireline operating companies, they were very protective of their network, and they didn't want to see the world change. So they they were reluctant to have anything like a cell phone come online. They were reluctant to even see data coming across their networks. And even though voice was a very poor user of the capacity of their system, because over a voice line, everybody found out later, you could send loads and loads of data and still be talking over the same line at the same time and never know it.
Which is how we do our Zoom calls today.
Right, exactly.
Got it.
And there's so much that can be sent over in the technology that went into compacting voice and data and all those kind of things. All that stuff, a lot of it had been sitting there. Bell Labs had developed it, but the companies didn't want to see it rolled out. Well, all of a sudden, it became competitive. They had to get it out because somebody else was going to roll it out.
Huh.
And so then you saw eventually the recombining of some of the Bell operating companies. But then the big thing that tore it apart was cell phones. I told somebody the other day, I said, my first cell phone, I was in sales. This was in 1987. It's farther down in my career. Well, if you want to, we'll come back to it. But my first cell phone was we call them a brick.
Yeah.
And they upsized the two bricks, and you carried it around, and it would fit in your car, and you'd plug it into the lighter, and it actually had a phone, like a regular phone handle like they used to have on a regular phone.
Yes, yes.
And then you'd take it into a meeting in a conference room or something. You sit down on the corner on the wall because it had a big battery and everything with it, and you had to keep it plugged in and charged. And that was that was the beginning of the end as far as everything related to cells. So that was in the mid-80s. And, of course, it was very similar to the – they had the similar view to the to what the IBM had was, you know, a few computers will cover the world, that'll be it. Well, you know, it was the same feeling came out of the Bell operating company. You know, there'll be some people want cell service, but most people, you know, no way. You know, it'll be, you know, nothing anybody will want. They won't be able to afford it and all that.
Wow, a little short-sighted there.
Oh, yeah, they were very short-sighted. Hmm. Same thing with data. They didn't want data going over their lines. And so that's how the cable companies got into voice.
Because really?
They could easily put voice on cable systems because they had a huge amount of capacity. But the phone companies, although they had a lot of capacity, did not want that data coming over their lines. Huh. And it was just, you know, it was just no foresight. And now I'll go back to working at Bell Labs. After I worked at Bell Labs for 2 years, all this divestiture stuff was going on. It didn't affect us directly because the work we were doing was stuff that the operating companies needed no matter what. So
okay.
It didn't have a direct impact on us, but this was all happening, kind of swirling around our heads. And I found out that although when I took the interview in New Jersey and everything for the job, I thought I could live there, but I lived in Arizona too long. And and I said, this is nuts. I don't, you know, it's gray and cloudy all the time. And
ooh.
It was a great company to work for as far as benefits and pay. And, you know, it was very prestigious, but you had to live in New Jersey.
Right.
And so I started looking for a job after 2 years and got a job working for Exxon Production Research Corporation in Houston, Texas. So I went from the two companies that were the biggest in the world, AT&T, to the other one, which is Exxon, that went back and forth at that time as being the companies with the most wealth in the world, actually.
You know, Charlie, before you leave Bell Labs,
yeah,
in 1976, as a software programmer, what kind of operating program were you using? I mean, were you using punch cards? How were you writing software at the time?
Yeah, we were beyond that. In fact, by the time I finished graduate school, we were still building the same kind of format like you would see on a punch card, but it was done they were called the mini computers, and they'd have like, 100 screens hooked up to them, and you could sit there and type, and you were building the same kind of thing you would on a card. Only it was on a file on this mini computer.
Oh, wow.
And then you
okay.
could submit it to the mainframe. And that would run through just as if you'd submitted a deck of cards.
Okay.
So in graduate school, between my first two classes, undergraduate, and then getting into graduate school, cards, punch cards, and that kind of stuff were phasing out or being phased out.
And was that COBOL? What was the name of the program you were using for that?
Okay, well. When I first went to work at Bell Labs, I was using COBOL, and I also used Fortran.
Yep.
Fortran. And then we used PL1, which is a kind of a combination of both of them that was invented by IBM. And we were working on IBM systems at Bell Labs.
Okay.
We were using many computers to build the files and the programs, but they had to run on the IBM mainframes. So that's where we submitted our jobs from our mini computer to the mainframe, and then it would run through, and then we'd get the results and make changes and so on. So that was our programming environment, was on these mini computers, but the actual programs, when they were installed and put in operation, had to run on the mainframes that the telephone operating companies had. So that was part of our process. After we created our system for them, we would have to go out, and it was always on a weekend. They would shut down. It was part of their regular day-to-day operation, but on the weekends it was low-key, so they would pick the weekend. We'd go out there. We'd shut down their old system, and we had to have it converted over to the new system by 6 o'clock Sunday evening, and if we didn't, we had to put it back the way it was.
Oh, wow.
By 6 o'clock the next morning, Monday morning. so that people coming to work could go back to doing what they wanted,
right,
or what they had to do. So those were long 48-hour periods of making sure. And you had all this data you had to convert from one system to another. And some of that we could do ahead of time, but the big thing was getting in there, getting stuff done, and getting it set up so that when Monday morning they came in, it was new to them, but they had been trained on it, but so they expected it.
Okay.
But it wasn't the old system. But if we couldn't get the new one running by 6 o'clock Sunday evening, we had to cut back to the old one.
Wow. That's a little pressure.
It was pressure. You're young, though. It was fun. It was interesting.
Yeah. Cool. Trying to problem solve.
Good money,
yeah.
So I can't argue with, any of that. It was a company that, at that time, had plenty of money. Being essentially a sole provider, the money that they could ask for, even though it was a regulated industry, the regulators didn't have much alternatives. If the phone company said, we need to raise rates to cover this, the regulators can't say, well, we're going to go to so-and-so because so-and-so didn't exist.
Right.
They'd have to argue with them a little bit, but, eventually they'd probably have to give in. So, and they provided the money to Bell Labs for the work we were doing. So if we needed something, you just wrote a requisition and, maybe a paragraph of why you needed it, and then the next day or two it'd show up.
Wow.
And, there was some monitoring of it and some, we weren't allowed to abuse it totally, but you certainly didn't have a difficult time getting what you needed when you needed it to get, a project done. So it was, it was a heyday as far as that kind of activity, being in that kind of, and my area was applied research, of course. There's the pure research people were a different type of people. I've never been able to even think about approaching that level. But these are the pure research people are the ones that created or invented like the transistor and lasers and all those things. They came out of Bell Labs as well, but they were in a unit of Bell Labs that had people that sat around and thought about things, and they would go off and do something, and then maybe once a year they'd have to make a presentation on what they were doing. And a lot of stuff they might have created nobody even had a use for yet.
Wow.
But they had created it and patented it, and that was a big thing at Bell Labs. Patent. If you did something and you thought it was patentable, they wanted you to patent it as quick as you could so they could protect it.
Okay.
So that was one part of Bell Labs that I never was involved in. That was the pure research part.
And then just 2 years later, you're going to sell that home and buy a new house in Houston. That's a lot of moving around, too.
Yeah, but see, I think we alluded to earlier, I moved a lot when I was a kid, so
that's right.
Moving to me wasn't, a big deal. And my son was still not in school yet.
Okay.
So moving to Houston wasn't he was in day school, but he wasn't in a regular school at that
right.
point in time.
Right.
And my wife did work at that time, but my then wife worked at that time as well. But, she was clerical type work, and so for her to move with us, or for us to move together and find another job for her and get him in another day school and stuff like that was not difficult.
And it would have been super easy if she wasn't, real happy with the place either, Piscataway.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the only saving grace to New Jersey in her eyes was it was only a couple hours from her parents' house in Northeast Ohio. Essentially you get on the Pennsylvania Turnpike and, 2.5-3 hours you were there. Now, that was a downside in my mind.
Okay. All right.
But that was an upside on.
But I would think Houston is not Tucson.
No, it's not. But at the time, I couldn't find a job in Tucson.
Oh, okay.
And so, I'll get close. And my parents then were living in, had moved from Northeast Ohio to Southeast Texas. And my dad worked for what became the company he worked for became part of Texaco. And he was working down there. And my sister lived down there. And so I just kind of started looking around down there for jobs. And this one came up at Exxon. And they offered to move me and everything. It set us up, and we were getting ready to, we went down there and went and found a place to have a house built. And 6 months later, I was looking for no reason that I could think of. And I saw this ad for a job in Phoenix. And I said to my wife, I'm going to apply for this job. If we end up with it, we're going back to Arizona. Are you okay with that? And she said, sure. So I got the job. In fact, when I had the interview, I told them, look, I don't need more money. I just want you to move me back here. And so they didn't pay me any more money. They just moved me back here. But they did hire me in Phoenix then to start working at a company that was back with a phone company. It was GTE, which was most people, unless they had a GTE phone, before the divestiture, GTE was the second largest phone company in the United States. And they had a few areas where they were the major company. Well, around the outer areas around Dallas, they had all of Hawaii, a lot of areas in the Midwest, like Indianapolis and Des Moines, Iowa, and, you know, kind of major cities and areas in the Midwest that AT&T never went after because they were small potatoes. They didn't have Chicago, but they had some of the suburbs before Chicago grew out to them. So it was probably about one-fifth the size or less, maybe one-sixth the size of AT&T. And most people, unless they had GTE for some reason, didn't even know it existed. But it was kind of the AT&T didn't want them to die because here's our competition, you know.
To show that,
we're not the ones in the world. So, and GTE was set up very much like AT&T. They had a manufacturing arm, which was called GTE Automatic Electric. They had a research and development, which is GTE Automatic Electric Laboratories. And they had a GTE Pure Research facility in Waltham, Massachusetts.
Huh.
And that looked at doing similar things. You know, they didn't do well. They did some pretty good things too, as far as research is concerned. And then they had their operating companies that were, you know, GT Southwest, which was down around the outskirts of the Dallas area. They had a lot of the what became parts of Dallas, which at the time were small little towns, you know, 20 miles outside of Dallas. Dallas eventually chewed up or ate up or whatever, and around Houston the same way, and some San Angelo, Texas, and a bunch of areas.
What were you doing in Phoenix?
Well, it was an interesting story in that too, because their lab, their application lab, similar to the lab I'd worked at Bell Labs, was in the Chicago area. In my wife's not here right now. She's got a better memory for names than I do. But anyways, a suburb of Chicago. And that facility was adjacent to the manufacturing facility up there as well. And the vice president of the laboratories had, and this is the way the story was told to me, had a son going to ASU, and he liked it down there. And he was able to sell the up higher level people in GD that by setting up a lab in Phoenix, we'd be able to recruit. They would be able to recruit better engineers and, you know, higher quality because of the weather and all that stuff. And somehow he sold that, and so they took the lab and they moved it to Phoenix.
Okay.
And then when they got down here, they were starting a brand new product, a digital switching system, and it was to replace all the old equipment that was not computer run at that time. And this was in 1978. And they were just starting to staff that, but they still had their old systems, and they had to keep those pretty well staffed because they still had, you know, maintenance things and some new features going into those. So they were looking for a lot of new engineers, and so they started this new project in Phoenix. And so that's the ad I saw, and that's the ad I applied for. And when I interviewed, it was in a great big room with a desk, like five desks set up in different corners of the room, and they were interviewing engineers.
Wow.
And
like five at a time?
Yeah, in this huge room. But, I mean, we were separated far enough apart in this big room that you wouldn't hear each other.
Right.
But it was going to be where they were going to set up all the cubicles and everything for all the developers and all that stuff.
Okay.
They just hadn't gotten that far. They were trying to hire people as fast as they could.
Huh. Wow.
So I lucked out, and I got hired, and they paid for our move to Phoenix. So we moved to Phoenix, and there I started out, again, writing software, only this time it was for a telephone switching system rather than a management system. So it was entirely new language. We developed new there was a research language that was used by computer scientists for doing theoretical studies and stuff like that, called Pascal.
Yes.
But it had never been written as a formal programming language.
Oh, wow.
So the people in our area that did that kind of thing developed a real compiler and everything else that we could use that language to write code.
Hmm.
And it was very novel in a lot of respects, and it prevented people from making some mistakes that other languages would let you do inadvertently, like confuse characters with numbers and stuff.
Oops.
Like that. So, yeah, right. And so this language, by its implementation, would not allow you to make those kind of mistakes. So it was really, and when you're pulling a bunch of people together from different places with different degrees of discipline on their programming and everything, you didn't want to have to go through a whole bunch of friction of just syntax errors. And this prevented syntax errors by the way this language is structured. So it was really good for a new project, bringing all these people from all over together.
Cool.
And we started that work, and then they decided to move all those other operations down here as well. So they built a building on the north, on I-17, just short of where now the whatever that road is that comes across the northern edge of Phoenix.
The 303? No, that's too far out. Are you thinking not the 51, but the 101? Or the 202? The 101.
Yeah. We were right at 101 and I-17 to build a big building. Of course, 101 wasn't there then. And they built a great big building there, and Digital Equipment was just south of us in a big building. So kind of its own little... the company that builds chips, they built another factory just north of us. So, I mean, it was kind of becoming a little corridor of computers and computer science and all that kind of stuff. And then Honeywell was just down the road, and they hired a whole bunch of people from Honeywell.
Wow.
As well as, you know, myself in Houston and other places. And pulled us all in there, and then they brought down a few people that from the Chicago area and transferred those people down who knew what a telephone switch was, because most of us they hired had no idea what a telephone switch was or what it did. But we could write code if somebody would tell us what we're supposed to do. So I started out with people writing these big, extensive documents telling us, okay, you pick up the phone, you get a dial tone, then digits are going to come, and then you got to collect those, you got to analyze those digits, and you got to figure out to route the code, the call, and you got to send the signal to the other end to tell them to ring the line, and when they pick it up, you got to connect them together and all this stuff. Well, that was all, you know, to us at that time, wow, that's pretty cool how that works, you know. And so, but it ends up, you know, it's last time when, and this has been, you know, over 20 years now, when I left, it was between 12 and 15 million lines of code.
Wow.
So it's not a trivial thing to do. So, and it took us a good 5 years to have a product that we could first put into the network and see how it worked. But after that, you know, we had problems right at the beginning, just like Bell Labs had problems with theirs. They were doing the same thing we were doing. Ours was called a GDD5. which is a level 5 switch in the Jeep, what's it called? General Telephone digital level 5 switching system or something like that. Anyways, GTD5. Bell Labs was building the same thing in parallel for their network, and it was called the 5ESS.
Hmm.
It was a level 5 switching system, electronics signaling and switching system or something like that. So we were in parallel, and they were building theirs for their network. Of course, they had companies that had been broken up, but were still pretty much reliant on their hardware. And at the same time, we had GT had not broken up their company. They had not been forced to divest yet, but they did have to open up the network to new suppliers as far as hardware and stuff like that.
Hmm.
So in any case, the when we started rolling out the switches, you know, it's like, people, you know, when you had a wireline phone, you expected when you picked up that phone, you were going to have dial tone.
Right.
I mean, there was nothing in your mind that you ever thought that would occur.
Something was wrong. If you didn't hear that, you knew something was wrong.
Yeah. And a couple times a year, believe it or not, that was very possible. One of them was Mother's Day. Because they only have so much capacity in different pieces of equipment. So the switch was never made, even the old ones, were never made for everybody to be able to make a phone call at the same time.
Oh, interesting.
They made traffic studies, and they saw the average traffic in this area of phone calls was maybe 2,000 calls an hour.
Okay.
So that's the way they built or sized the switches. They might even size them up and say, we'll have it so it can handle 3,000 calls an hour. And so there were times in the older networks, the hardwired ones, that you would pick up a phone, you wouldn't get a dial tone. And it was because there was no equipment to connect to you to give you a dial tone.
Hmm.
Well, when we went to digital switches, of course, they gave us all these parameters on how these work, so that's what we built. But when it went to the extremes, this is something that people do software these days always much smarter about than we were, you know, to test the extremes.
Right.
What happens in the worst case?
Yes.
Or, you know, what happens when somebody does something wrong? What are you going to do in that case? And that kind of stuff. And so we learned a lot. And we improved a lot. And we ended up building huge testing scenarios and things like that so that we could release and put out new releases of the software and make sure or be relatively sure that they were going to work just fine in the network. But in any case, this all evolved over my 20 years and working for that company. And I went from being a programmer to a supervisor to a director. And then I went to sales for a short time because I was on a path more or less for a career and you needed some time in sales. And so I went into sales for a year. And then back out of that and back into program management and then vice president of research and development. And then toward the end of my career, looking at new products and new opportunities and things like that.
Cool. Did you stay in Phoenix all that time?
Yes. Yes. But that's where I met CL. And that was, you know, kind of out of that was, you know, where I got my first trip to the Grand Canyon and all those things.
Okay. Roughly 2000 then, you retired with those guys?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
What's that, dear? The end of 1999. She wants to make sure I'm accurate.
Okay, end of 1999. All right. So you've landed now in Phoenix, and it's nice because you're back in the desert. And Grand Canyon now is not too far away, but
right.
Neither is Tucson or any
right.
You know, the superstitions, all kinds of things.
Yep.
Did you start doing more running or more backpacking or more hiking or all of the above, sort of 1979, 1980?
Yeah. Well, what happened was, like I said, there were people hired from all over the country, and they set us in this big building, this big open space, and they put us in cubicles with, you know, walls that were 5 feet tall and stuff. And
yep.
So during the day, you'd talk to each other, and one of the guys in the cubicle next to me was from New York State. He had worked for Kodak in Buffalo, and he was into running. He was a runner, and he started talking to me, and I started like, yeah, right. And I had run in, when I was in the Air Force, because you had to, in order to stay qualified, you had to run a mile and a half in 12 minutes or less.
Okay.
And so I had run enough to keep that up. But, you know, it was kind of like, oh, I got to do this test in a couple of months. I guess I better get out there. And in fact, one time I was getting ready and doing my running and stepped on a rock and broke my ankle.
Oh, my gosh. And whoa.
So I had to go, you know, with a cast and get all that put off. And there was a whole bunch of rigmarole about that. But in any case, it was something that, you know, I did casually. But he also rode his bicycle to work. And I had thought about that because I knew I was getting, at that time, that was 1978. So I was 40 or 34. Is that right? Yes. Yeah, that was right. 34, 35. I had put on some weight when I went to Korea and I came back. And so even in college, I didn't do too much, but I did kind of watch it. But I was putting on weight, and I thought, well, I need to really get some exercise, get my weight down. He was riding his bike back and forth to work. So I found an old used bike, and I rode back and forth. And then he was talking about running, and so we got into talking about that. And so I started running a little bit. And after months I ran a 10K and another 6 months or so I ran a marathon. And
wow,
you know, it's one of those things that once you get started, it was kind of, at that time, running was really starting to become a big deal, and a lot of people were writing books and all kinds of stuff. So it was interesting and it was fun, and it was kind of a group of people, you know, that I became, you know, friends with, that I ran with and things like that. And this guy eventually moved back to New York State, but by then I had quite a few other people that I knew, and we, you know, were running together and stuff like that. And what came up, when I lived in Tucson all those, that 10 years plus or whatever, I had never gone to the Grand Canyon. And somebody had the idea of, in my work group, why don't some of us get together and we'll take a raft trip down the Grand Canyon? Oh, yeah, well, what the heck, why not? So at that time, it was going to be one of the five-day, four nights to Phantom Ranch on an ore-powered.
Okay.
And, you know, so we got up to Flag, and I think I told you before, it's Grand Canyon Youth Expeditions.
Yes.
And then we went from Lee's Ferry down to Phantom Ranch, and then hiked out. And that had been my first time ever seeing the Grand Canyon, so I tell people I saw it from the bottom up.
You did indeed. Huh.
Yeah.
So really, this was 1979, 1980?
Okay, now I have made notes, so I got to give me a minute to pull those up, because I knew there were going to be dates here pretty
soon. Oh, yes, please.
Where I was going to get stuck. So I've gone back through some of my stuff, and I've been able to find, now if I can find the notes where I put them. Here it is. So, 1980, June 3rd, 1980, first time at Grand Canyon, raft trip with Grand Canyon Youth Expeditions, you know, June 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th, the Phantom Ranch, with hikes in Buckhorn, Saddle Canyon, Nanquip, Little Colorado, and then hiking the Bright Angel out. So that, you know, I had done stuff as a Boy Scout and things like that when I was a kid. And growing up, I was really active in Boy Scouts. I did a lot of camping, went to Philmont, which is a National Scout Ranch in New Mexico. But in between times, when I went in the Air Force and got married and had family and all that kind of stuff, that all kind of went by the way. I didn't do much at all in that regard.
Okay.
But this kind of sparked that interest again. Hmm. And when I hiked out Bright Angel, by then I'd been running regularly, so I was in good shape. And I got out in like 3.5 hours or something like that.
Great.
And I thought, wow, this is really this. And that, you had to carry your gear out too. And I thought, wow, this is really great. This is fun. I'm going to have to look up and see if there's, you know, something else, you know, somehow I can get involved in this. And so the next thing was in February of 1981, that was a little over 6 months later, there was Glendale Community College had a non-credit course for a three-day rim-to-rim backpacking trip. And that's where I met CL. CL and a friend of his that he had grown up with, who was a teacher at Glendale, had put together this three-day rim-to-rim backpack.
Okay, hang on a second. Before we, Charlie, before we get to CL and this three-day rim-to-rim, let's go back to the Grand Canyon Youth River trip. These were 22-foot snouts, your boats, with and they were oar-powered, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Do you remember who your boat people were?
Well, I know one of them was the guy that builds the boats right now, that's lives in Flag, and he's built some of the representative boats of the boats, the first stuff that went through the Grand Canyon, and what the heck is his name? I'm sorry. Oh, Denise is going to look it up for me.
Okay.
Anyway, he's written a couple of books about the Grand Canyon, people rafting and all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure you know when I say it, but I can't remember it right now.
Okay.
Any case, he was one of the people at that time that was working for McCullough and that. But
Dick McCallum wasn't on the trip.
Yes, he was.
He was. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
He had a big beard.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah, no, he was kind of a tall, not tall, but, yeah, kind of tall.
Kind of tall, large man, yep.
Yeah, yeah, big man, not heavy, but a
right.
big guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, but this other guy was not big like that. He was, in fact, he was younger than I am.
Brad Dimmick, sure.
Yeah, yeah, Brad Dimmick. He was one of the people, and the reason I know that is because my last trip to the canyon a few years ago, Brad was one of the parts of the company that put that on, and it was Dories and Stories.
Uh-huh.
So he took two of the Dories and he told stories every night. And I asked him, I said, you know, did you work back in this time frame? And we got to talking, and he was. And then on one of the other ones, and I don't remember this woman's name, it turned out it was some girlfriend of his that I was on another trip with.
Cool.
So it was all that happened. Because I've been through the canyon on three and a half times.
Okay.
So three times all the way through, and once on the first one, just at halfway to Phantom Ranch.
So what else do you remember about that river trip back in June of 1980?
Well, the hikes and the side canyons and stuff, you know, getting into there, and Nanakuip I thought was so cool with the little granaries up there at the top, and those kind of things, a little Colorado, and, you know, that may be confusing the trips in my mind, but, you know, the majority of the people that were on the trip with me were people that I had been working with. So, you know, every night we had the meal and stuff, and we had taken along plenty of beer and other things to drink and stuff. So it was pretty good time, I have to admit. And maybe I don't remember some of it so well as I should, but I just remember it being just a really heck of an experience because I'd never done anything like that before.
Okay.
And it just opened up a whole wide range of possibilities in my mind as to, you know, things to do and things to see. And I've always... And this is part of maybe you can look at it a lot of different ways. But I was looking back on it, kind of reflected, you know, that when I grew up, as I mentioned, we moved a lot. And moving a lot never seemed to bother me too much. And part of it was always somewhere new and somewhere else, something else to explore. And what's on the other side of that hill and what's over there
yeah.
and all that kind of stuff. And I think that was, I don't know if that was the result of my moving as a youth or just my curiosity as a normal person and the way I developed. I don't know. But in my mind, sometimes when I reflect back, I think, well, maybe that's why part of the reason it never bothered me a lot to move and go from one place to another, because I always thought, well, there's going to be something there that I'm going to be interested in. I'll find something new over that hill or over that way or somewhere, you know, I hadn't been before. So any case, I went back through my notes, and unfortunately, like I said, I kept dates and times more or less, but I did not keep a lot of information with regards to who was there with me, when, and that kind of stuff. And, and afterwards, when we got done, we did have a party, and there were two women I can remember who were like 70 years old, and that time we thought that was really old. And they were on the raft with us. And they went on to go all the way through, and they were from Phoenix. So when we got together afterwards to compare pictures and all that, we invited them, and they had pictures for the rest of the way down and all that kind of stuff.
Cool.
And so we got a chance to find out what the rest of the trip was like and those people. But like I said, at that time, we thought they were terribly old people to be doing this.
So what were your thoughts when you got to the top? I'm assuming you would have hiked up the Bright Angel Trail.
Yep.
And we got past the Kolb studio and walked over to the Bright Angel maybe for an ice cream or something at the top or a trip to the bar. Look back into the canyon. What were you thinking?
Well, there's two things. I always tell people that one of the things, when I got to the rim, I didn't have a watch. I didn't wear a watch and I don't wear one now. It was just a habit anyway. When I got to the top, I didn't know what time it was, and I didn't know how long it had taken me since I left the river, and I wasn't with any of the other people. They were still back behind me a ways.
Okay.
And so I had to ask like four people before I got one to speak English.
Oh, wow.
There were all these people at the Bright Angel Trailhead, but most of them, they were from other places, and they didn't know what I was asking.
As a world destination, so yeah.
Yeah. At that time, I mean, it was June, and there were all these people on holiday from all over the world. And they just happened to be there, and I joked, but it was serious. It took me, I think, three people or four people before I finally got one that could speak English and understood what I wanted to know. And then I hung around there because I had never been to the South Rim. I didn't know there was a place for ice cream. I didn't know anything.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Except I was at the trailhead, and I didn't want to wander too far because I didn't know we had somebody supposed to meet us and haul us back to Phoenix.
Right.
So I hung out there for a while until everybody came out. And most of us were in that kind of a situation because, like I said before, they recruited us from all over the United States. And the people that were on that trip, for all of us, it was the first time for, you know, seeing the Grand Canyon. And so when we all got together at the top, then we did walk around and check some things out and found the ice cream and all that kind of stuff. But I didn't leave the trailhead when I got to the top because I didn't know how I was going to get home until those guys got back out and we all got together.
Okay, yeah. That makes sense.
So then we all went back at that point in time, drove back, and that was my first experience. And when I looked at the canyon, I was just amazed. But I can tell you, every time I've been there, I've been amazed. I've been there just about once every year since then, so that's what, been 40 years?
Yeah.
At least once and many, many times some years. And I'm always just the sheer grandeur and the challenge of it. And I know some people don't see it as a challenge, but to me it's always getting in and getting out is the challenge. And part of it is just saying, okay, I can do that.
Yeah.
And, and some people that's not even a concern on their part because they never even thought about doing it. But that was kind of from the beginning. I thought about, wow, just to be able to go through there and exist in there and come out and go back again. That's really something. That's a really cool place to be. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe this is a good time to introduce CL.
Okay.
CL stands for what?
Clarence. Denise is going to look it up for me.
Okay.
I mean, for a long time, you would not tell us what CL stood for.
Really?
I'm not sure what the L stood for until I saw Zobit. And we were pretty close, but he never liked being called Clarence. That was not, so he never, when he told me one day in private, he never, to my knowledge, I'm sure Frank knew, but most people that we went with at different times, he never would have told them what CL stood for.
Okay.
And he was, Quad, not Clarence. His name was Quad Lorace, L-O-R-A-C-E.
Okay. And he was working for GT as well?
No. He was working for the government at that time. Yeah, this was...
Okay.
I met him was through this non-credit course at Glendale Community College. There was... You know, after we'd gotten back to work and everything, and I got a position teaching part-time at Glendale Community College, teaching programming languages.
Okay.
And one of the things they had there, you know, whenever they put out their, you know, each semester what they were going to have, they had credit and non-credit courses. So I was looking through, you know, to make sure my class was in there and everything was going to go as planned. And I was teaching Fortran and COBOL during that time at Glendale Community College. So, and it was in the evenings. So, you know, it was after I got off work and I would go over there and try to teach people how to program, which turned out much more difficult than I thought it was.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, you can teach people syntax real easy, but to teach them to program is a whole different world.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was cool. But I enjoyed that, too. I always enjoyed teachings, too. So,
cool.
With a few exceptions, there were people that got very upset with me because I couldn't reach them, and I didn't know what to tell them.
It's hard. I mean, it's a hard thing to learn, and not everybody gets it. And they stare at you going, you're supposed to teach me, and I don't get it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and you try the thing with the recipe. Think of it, you know, you're baking a cake. What do you have to do? You got to follow these steps. You got to do it this way. Okay, now think of it this problem. What do you have to do? What needs to come in? What needs to go out? How do you get from A to B? You know, from what's in to what's out. And like I said, you can teach them syntax. They can understand, you know, this has to end with a period and this has to be this or that. And this is how you do a plus or a equal or whatever. Or but when you get
greater than, less than, you know, forward slash. Yeah. And
Yeah. And but to think of a solution and then be able to incorporate it using that syntax was a whole different game. But like I said, I enjoyed it. But anyway, in the catalog, they had non-credit courses as well. And I spotted this one, which was a three-day rim-to-rim backpack trip. And
so 3 days, that's two nights.
Right. One night, and it turned out one night, and that's just my memory anymore. No, not Phantom Ranch. Before that.
Havasupai Gardens?
No, up on the...
Cottonwood.
Yeah, Cottonwood Campground.
Okay.
We were coming north to south.
Ah.
Cottonwood Campground. And then at that time, what was Indian Gardens, Havasupai Gardens now, the second night, and then we'd be out. So the long day would be really the one from Cottonwood to Havasupai Gardens.
Right. And there's lots to see and do there, like the Colorado River and Phantom Ranch and you know, right near the creek.
Stop,
so
you got to keep going.
Yeah. I got bridges to look at and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. So, and this was, again, an eye-opening trip for me. So, I signed up for the class.
Yep.
And I was running a lot then, you know, so I felt I was going to be fine as far as conditioning. And I had to go out and buy a backpack because I hadn't had a backpack for years.
Where did you buy it?
I went to, it was a Craftsman, and it actually had a nylon frame, kind of half inside, half, it was mostly outside the frame, you know, the external frame, and the pack that hung on it, and it was, trying to think of what REI didn't exist in Tucson or Phoenix then. There was a I went there later. My wife was saying the hiking shack in Cave Creek on Cave Creek in Phoenix. I used to go there later on, but there was a group of outdoor stores in Phoenix that kind of sold themselves as military surplus, and I cannot remember the name. But in any case, that's where I went and got my first sleeping bag and backpack, real ones that I, you know, that I'd never had before. Even as a kid, I had a backpack and a K-POC sleeping bag that you froze to death in. But
right, right.
Yeah, not anything real. And so, this and a tent. And so, in any case, I signed up for this course.
Oh, my gosh.
My friend were running the program. And they had a couple of meetings beforehand, and they wanted to get everybody together and get them out hiking so they know what to expect.
So CL was teaching this, or was he another student?
CL?
Yeah.
No, he was. It was a non-credit course.
Right.
So this guy who was, he was the teacher at Glendale Community College, but it was something to do with PE is what he taught. And CL was, and this guy went to school together.
Okay.
And I guess this guy said to CL, or somehow they decided this guy was going to put on the class and he needed somebody to help him, and CL got drafted into helping him out with that.
Okay.
Now, CL had been doing some hiking in the Grand Canyon before that, and Frank probably with Frank, I'm not sure exactly, because Frank, when I hiked with CL, Frank was pretty much done doing backpacking. He wasn't doing much backpacking after that point.
Okay.
He had some physical problems and
right.
stuff like that, with the exception of the one where he lost his watch. And that's down, you know, a few years later.
Okay.
But in any case, so CL was with him. And so we got down to, and CL's daughter came along, the one that's the youngest one, and one of her friends. And there were probably 8 or 10 of us. And we got to Cottonwood that night, and we were in a group camp area that's above where the little building is, just up above that a little bit.
Okay.
There was a group area. And during the night, these little skunks came in and were trying to get into packs. And, you know, I didn't know CL from anybody at that point in time. And he's up there shining a light, and he shined a light on them, and they run off. And we were sleeping outside. We weren't in a tent or anything. We were just on ground cloth laying there. And one of them went in his pack, and he went over and thumped it on the butt. And I thought, this guy is crazy. That skunk is going to spray us. We're all going to be... I just thought, this guy has no idea what he's doing. And, of course, the skunks ran off, and they'd be gone for an hour or maybe, and then you wake up, and they were scurrying around again. So it was kind of a restless night of, you know, chasing the skunks away. But the next day we got up, made breakfast, and we headed on down to the river and then back up to Havasupai Gardens. And everybody except DL and I were dead. I mean, they were hurting. It was a long day, and none of them were really, even this guy who was CL's friend, were probably in good enough shape. They probably would have been in great shape if we'd stopped at Phantom Ranch and
yes.
spent another night, and then another night up to Havasupai, and then Gardens, and then on out. But or Havasupai. But that long down and then back up, and then that night there was a big storm up on the rim, and they moved us all up into a building. So I was sleeping in the old plastic tube tents.
Yes.
Yep, and had one of those set up, and so just my sleeping bag, and I was slipped down in that. But they came down and woke us all up, and they said they were worried about flash flood coming down through there.
Uh-huh.
And so they woke up the whole campground and moved us into one of these their little buildings just up out of the flood zone, evidently, and had us all packed in there. I mean, we were packed in.
Wow.
Sitting on the floor, you know, knees to butt and all that kind of stuff. And that went on for 2 or 3 hours because you could hear the storm just booming away and all that kind of stuff. And then they finally said, okay, come on out. And we went back down. And, of course, there was no tube tent to be found.
Oh, no.
Some were blown away. But some of the bigger tents were blown away as well. And then we spent the rest of the night and got up the next morning and hiked out. And it was it's still, it's a hard hike out that mile, or was it three, let me see, 4.5 miles.
Yeah, something like that.
3 miles, yeah. And so we got to the rim. And again, I got up there pretty quickly, and CL got up there, and then we sat around and waited. And we had vans from the school then, from Glendale Community College, that were part of the, they were able to get us part of the program, and they picked us up and drove us back. And that was my first one.
And that was 1981?
That was 1981, February of 1981.
Oh.
Oh, so, I'm sorry. That's when we met. The hike was on January, March, May. I got 5:30, 5:31, and 6:01.
Okay, so getting hot, not super hot yet, but getting there.
Right, right. It was, I didn't, you know, May is really the first time the North Rim's open, even.
Right.
So,
that's right.
We couldn't go much earlier than that. So it was 5:30, 5:31, and 6:01, and it was the North Rim, Cottonwood, Indian Gardens, and then the South Rim we were out.
Okay. Maybe this is a good place now to put a comma in this interview series, because
okay.
I think there's another Grand Canyon hike coming up here.
Yes.
Okay. Is there anything you want to add to what we've covered that I didn't ask you about?
You know, I kind of jumped around on the part of my working and stuff, and I don't know if that was a good idea or not, but maybe you'll listen to it and you have questions, or maybe I need to clarify that.
I thought it was good.
Maybe, okay.
Yeah. No, I
was really lucky during that time to be in that particular situation, and it gave me an opportunity to grow as far as responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me an opportunity to grow as far as money, so I was able to retire relatively early. And my wife's pointing at herself, and I got to meet her.
Okay. Cool.
I had when I came back from overseas, and my wife had, and I had my first wife, and I, my son was born, and we were in trouble before I went overseas, but we didn't fare much better. And so after we had moved to Phoenix, and we had separated and got a divorce. So that all happened in that interim when we first got to Phoenix.
Okay.
And
when did you meet Denise?
We actually worked together. She worked at the same company.
At GTE?
Yeah. The parts. She was initially, when I didn't know her, she and I actually started. She actually started there before I did.
Okay.
But she started up in the Chicago area when the plant and everything was up there.
Hmm.
And she eventually worked in started out in manufacturing area, I think, right? Oh, did you start in R&D? Okay. Yeah, she started in research and development as well, although she didn't have a programming background. She was a excellent librarian.
Okay, cool.
But she had worked for GTE, the labs in Waltham, Massachusetts, that I mentioned before. Huh? Oh, Sylvania. Okay. Okay. But anyway, in that part of the world. And she had also been divorced and had moved back to the Chicago area where her parents were and her family.
Okay.
And she got transferred and was able to get a position with GTE in the Chicago area with the manufacturing and all that stuff. So she and I didn't meet then again at all until like 4 years in after we were. Yeah, we were both working there 4 years. I'd gotten divorced, and I had moved from research and development into first into product. Right. She's helping me out here.
Cool.
She's
cool.
In some respects, her memory is better than mine, but not always. We have some discussions sometimes.
That's all right. I mean, it's anyway, always helpful.
Yes, she was in project management. She had people that worked for her who had various projects throughout the country, and they worked for getting those projects done.
Okay.
And I was in program management at that time, and I had particular products that I was responsible for seeing that they got rolled out and got put in place. And so after a point in time, some of the people she had on projects being implemented were, and my products were the ones that were being implemented or put in place. So we met through that. And then along the way, we started dating and seeing each other and stuff.
Cool.
And she
so
had...
That would have been in 1982 then?
No, that was later than that. That wasn't until like 87 or 88.
Oh, okay.
So both of us were with the company for 5 or 6 years before we met. And then she was in Chicago and I was down here. And then there came a point when she had an opportunity to move down here. And she did. She had changed positions a couple times as well. She became the director for engineering and installation for the western part of the United States for
wow.
all of our products.
Cool.
And by then I was moving into, I'd gone from program and into full product management, and I had the largest product we had at that time, which was the GD5. And then I moved into R&D. Well, then I went into sales for that year and then into R&D. And when I think, was I in sales when we met? No. Sales was after that. Okay. So,
okay, well let's hold off on that now, because we're going to we're going to go back to you and CL in 1981 after that May May hiking trip.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Okay, well then with that, let's conclude part 3 of the Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Charlie Schultz. Today is Friday, March 3rd, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Charlie, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.